Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We have one case for argument, Overstreet against Wilson. Mr. Kahn.
Chief Judge, and may it please the court, good afternoon. Overstreet is a paranoid schizophrenic. He has both auditory and visual hallucinations and delusions that revolve around angels and demons that attempt to control his every action. These psychotic symptoms started in his adolescence and slowly developed and built into paranoid schizophrenia, including prior to the offense in question, prior to the trial. Overstreet attempted to get help to fight the problems that he was having, and his wife took him to Dr. Qualls, a family physician, who provided a prescription to a drug that only exacerbated the problem. The incidents became worse, and they worsened. He barricaded himself in his family home, feeling that people were attempting to kill him. He had been able to work, but the symptoms became worse and worse, and he wasn't able to work because he didn't consider himself safe enough to drive because he couldn't control his body to allow himself to safely drive to work. He did not know the extent of his illness. His family physician had provided a prescription to a drug that exacerbated the illness. He didn't disclose this illness. Over his life, he had been teased and ridiculed for his discussion of the visions that he was seeing, or he described them as visions, but what they were hallucinations and delusions. But what he described them as visions, he'd been ridiculed for that. So he kept them to himself. And that's normal, as the experts testified. Paranoid schizophrenics don't think they're sick. Their reality is what they perceive. They perceive the angels and demons. That's their reality. And the voices in this case, as testified to Dr. Coons, threatened him about the disclosure. So he always felt threatened, not only himself, but bad things would happen to his family if he were to disclose what he was seeing, what he perceived as his reality. The reason I focus on this schizophrenia up front is it touches upon the two issues that we intend to argue today. The first one relates to his attorney's ineffectiveness when they were discussing the opportunity to enter a life plea and avoid the death penalty. The second relates to the ineffective assistance of counsel at the mitigation phase when they presented an inaccurate and incomplete picture of what was available mitigating evidence, a very strong mitigating factor of paranoid schizophrenia. Turning to the first, Overstreet's attorneys were ineffective when he became floridly psychotic when they were discussing a life plea and they did nothing to maintain the status quo.
So, Mr. Kump, what light, if any, do you expect the Supreme Court's pending decisions in Loeffler and Missouri versus Fry to throw on this one of your theories?
I think it's going to have major impact on both the Sixth Amendment being applicable to this circumstance and what the remedy is going to be. I think when you look at the transcripts of that argument, it's clear that they recognize that no court has ever held that the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply in the plea negotiation process. This court's held it. Every circuit court that's federal circuit court that's addressed it has held that. And if you look at Hill, it talks about Lockhart versus Hill. It talks about how that sort of recognize that at least implicitly. So I think it's going to answer the Sixth Amendment question, and I think it's going to answer it
positively. Well, I mean, you're saying the Sixth Amendment question is pretty well established. I mean, you have to, because obviously on habeas review, if there's anything up in the air about this, there's no clearly
Correct.
Established law from the Supreme Court.
Where I think they're going to shed light on is what is the appropriate remedy. and it's unclear from looking at the transcripts of the argument what the Supreme Court's going to hold and what the remedy is. Is there going to be a remedy? What the remedy is going to be fashioned, and I think it.
Is there any reason to distinguish death penalty decisions from others? Justices Breyer and Alito seem to be making some comment.
Correct, and I think there was no contention that death should be treated differently. It's unclear.
Here's the difference, if there is one that I see. There was some concern, at least in some of the briefs in those cases, about the extent to which the prosecutor is even in a position to promise. Sentencing, for example, is normally done by judges. But in death cases, in most states, I think the charging decision to pursue a case as a death penalty case does rest in the prosecutor's office.
Correct. And I think when you look at our record, it clearly is undisputed that Overstreet would have accepted this life plea.
But the state argues that the evidence isn't really all that clear that there was a firm plea on the table.
I strenuously disagree with that contention. First, we have Post-Conviction Exhibit 14, which is a plea agreement fax with the fax header of the prosecutor's office. So we have the testimony of not only one trial counsel, but the mitigation specialist who accompanied him with the meeting where Mr. Overstreet became floridly psychotic. And you have the testimony of the expert who is also there. And they all talk about how we're here to discuss the life plea. What the state hinges their argument on is an attorney's testimony where he wasn't really sure when or where there was a full or a firm deal, and he didn't recall if it had been reduced to writing. But I think if you read his testimony fairly, and I think when you read it fairly, and it clearly supports that there was a life plea at some point, he didn't know when it became firm, and he didn't have a recollection whether or not it was ever in writing, reduced to writing. So I think the weight of the record supports that there was a plea existence. Now, to go back to your point on if Lafler and Missouri versus Fry are going to treat death penalty cases differently, certainly the oral argument brought that forward. Well, what do we do with death cases? Right? And that's a significant question because the harm, obviously, is you'd be alive versus you're dead, right? There's no bigger prejudice to a defendant, their life versus their death, if they had entered the plea. Mm-hmm. So I
find it odd. There's nothing you can do about this right now, but I find it very surprising that nobody was making an argument that Mr. Overstreet was incapable of assisting his attorney in the presentation of his defense. You know, an incompetence to stand trial sort of argument. Because what you're essentially saying is that there was a moment, anyway, when he was incompetent to participate effectively in his own defense, and this is the moment when this plea deal is presented to him and he flips out.
Well, a couple responses. One, it's not just that moment. I mean, he had, as the experts testify, he's paranoid schizophrenic, so he's carrying these.
That's Dr. Smith, right?
Dr. Smith
says this.
Yes.
We have actually, and I actually really want you can answer this briefly, but what I'm most interested in is actually your second point about alleged ineffectiveness of counsel that was unreasonably missed by the state courts at the sentencing stage, because I want you to be as precise as you possibly can at that as to where you think the state court came to an unreasonable application of the Strickland standard.
Okay. Would you like me to do that now?
Actually, I would prefer, yes, that you do that now, but it's up to you.
What, Where we have a couple arguments preceding, or where we've contested that AEDPA deference shouldn't be applicable because they misconstrued the Strickland test. They didn't when they were when they did the performance prong. They focused on they presented something, and all this stuff is just cumulative. Well, it's not, as we know from Wiggins, and as we know as reaffirmed in Porter versus McCollum, it's not whether you did something. It's whether when you stopped and when you made the choice not to take it to the next step, whether or not that was a reasonable tactical decision. In our mind, the Indiana Supreme Court cut it short. It was not only that there was a tactical decision that was made, there has to be an assessment of whether or not that was reasonable.
Well, I understand that, but I think I'm going to tell you that you're probably fighting an uphill battle if any of the Indiana courts ever came close to addressing this, because both Ilst and Harrington against Richter seem to say, you know, the state court can be pretty terse. So I understand you're making that argument, but maybe let's assume for the sake of argument that AEDPA does apply. If AEDPA doesn't apply, then whatever you're saying is even easier to go forward with. I take it you certainly in your brief are not saying that you have nothing to say if AEDPA.
No, absolutely AEDPA not. And in this case, when you have one expert saying that your client is paranoid schizophrenic, and you get in front of a jury and you present a stipulation during an expert's testimony who says that your client suffers from a behavior problem, right? The timing of the stipulation is what's horrendous in my mind. Is Dr. Ingham is on the stand, and he's testifying that this client suffers from a personality disorder. And they stop in the middle of his testimony and say, oh, by the way, here's a stipulation that Dr. Coons would say the same thing, that it's only a personality disorder. Then almost a second, maybe the first question or the second question, I forget exactly which one, is then Ingham gives his diagnosis as a personality disorder. And what the state was able to do, and first...
It was Smith, actually, who...
Dr. Smith. And so they have the stipulation that Dr. Smith says the same thing. And then immediately thereafter, the first or second question, trial counsel elicits from Dr. Ingham, who's on the stand, that he suffers from a personality disorder. So one, it's wrong. He's suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, which
or at least the depiction,
among other things.
He said a personality disorder and rule out for schizophrenia is what Dr. Ingham testified to. But what the state was able to do, well, first, it's wrong. I mean, as trial counsel, you should know what your experts are going to testify about, and they had no idea. Or they wouldn't have stipulated because they're not the same. And what it empowered the state to do, if you look at their closing argument again and again and again, they minimized the mitigation, said it's only a personality disorder. And at one point, and I can I have the transcript over there, I can provide the site and rebuttal. At one point, in the closing, the trial prosecutor says, I don't even know why they called Dr. Ingham.
It's at page 5322.
He said,
I know where you're talking about.
I don't even know why they called Dr. Ingham, because he was such a powerful witness for us.
Right. He says, I'm surprised that he was actually called by the defense, and goes on and really focuses on this. He was not schizophrenic, no multiple personalities going on here. He was not psychotic.
Correct. And that was the theme of their closing. And that's, you know, it's not only in their opening closing, but in their rebuttal closing to the jury, they hammer that this is only a personality disorder. And that's a behavior issue, right? They're playing on it's a behavior problem as a personality issue, when in fact he suffers from paranoid schizophrenia.
Now, can we be clear about what the trial court didn't wasn't there some confusion about whether the trial court had Dr. Smith's full report before it or just a letter? Did the state trial court have Dr. Smith's full report before it?
I know that in the post-conviction record, Dr. Smith's full report is there.
Right. But at the time of the original proceeding?
My understanding is that all they had was the two-page letter from Dr. Smith that describes his, that states his diagnosis but doesn't have any of his support corroborating information, the mental status evaluation he did.
And the court makes a mistake when it says both Dr. Smith and Dr. Engham have diagnosed the defendant with personality disorders. Dr. Smith has assessed it as schizoaffective disorder, and Dr. Engham schizotypal personality disorder.
Correct. So
that's just a mistake, because Dr. Smith explained that the schizoaffective disorder was schizophrenia plus depression. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, it's a mistake. And that's a mistake that's the result of trial counsel not effectively putting forward, not knowing what their expert had testified to, because they had stipulated incorrectly about it and putting in front of the jury and in the trial court inaccurate information, and that the prosecutor jumped on that.
So one of the things the Indiana Supreme Court says, though, is in the final analysis, this is pretty finely grained stuff, and it's not convinced that the jury would have drawn the lines that finely when it was deciding whether to recommend the death penalty or not. And so perhaps even if this was inadequate performance, there wasn't prejudice. That's what the Indiana Supreme Court concludes.
And that's unreasonable. It discounts, one, if the jury couldn't pick up on such a fine discussion, why on earth would the prosecutor have made that very fine discussion at the trial? The trial prosecutor jumped on this, knew the difference, and knew how that would impact a jury. So I think the record, the prosecutor's actions at the time of the trial, refute that finding. This was a jury that could discern the difference. And there's a big difference between a behavior problem and this person has a chemical imbalance in their brain that causes them to see angels and demons. And these angels and demons take the form of you know, body doubles. You know, am I Larry Comp here today arguing in front of the Seventh Circuit, or am I a demon arguing in front of the Seventh Circuit? In his reality...
The premise of this argument, I think, is an empirical one. That is, that jurors would see a difference in the way this condition is described. The state court thought not. You say yes. I wonder on what basis you say yes. Is there some empirical support for your proposition?
Obviously, in our briefs, we didn't... I believe there are studies...
The briefs doesn't cite any.
Correct.
And I wonder whether there are studies. I've done a little searching, but I haven't found a study of this kind of question, how schizophrenia or a related condition is described, whether it's described as schizoaffective personality disorder or schizotypal personality disorder or schizophrenia. It seems to me absolutely essential to your position that jurors respond differently to those descriptions. And yet, there is, at least not cited in your brief, there is no empirical support for that proposition about how jurors behave. One would think that under the AEDPA, that's vital.
I respectfully disagree. I think what we have to assess is
you want us to just take judicial notice of a disputable proposition of psychiatry. I don't know how we're going to do that and say the problem is that the state court had a different view of psychiatry from a bunch of lawyers.
Well, I think empirical data can help, but I don't think it's a make-or-break proposition for any Strickland claim that's in front of the court.
I don't see how it cannot be. You've got a finding by the state court that there's no functional difference. You've got to show that that's unreasonable, wacky. And it can't be enough just to have lawyers talk about it. You can't say, I believe it's wacky, therefore it must be wacky. There's got to be this is a proposition of medicine, proposition of psychiatry. There has to be some firmer basis for this proposition than that lawyers believe it.
Well,
Maybe we're the wacky ones, or maybe you're the wacky ones.
So let me ask a slightly different follow-up question, which is whether the record included what, say, the DSM defines these two conditions as. That might be a starting. That would be a professional source that begins to tell you what's the difference. Is there anything like that?
The DSM...
I
know for schizotypal personality disorder, the DSM is in there, and I do believe also for the schizophrenia, the DSM is in the post-conviction.
So your position would have to be, if the jury had been if the definitions had been given to them, it would have been enough different from, which we could look at ourselves, from what the state prosecutor was saying in the closing argument, that a normal person would realize that these were two different things.
Correct. And I think that closing argument is important in that it demonstrates that the prosecutor realized that there was a distinction and argued that to the jury to minimize the mitigation that was put out there. And I think defense counsel were powerless to respond to that and they were powerless to respond to that because they had no idea what their expert had opined and that it was different than what Dr. Engham opined. And then in post-conviction, it comes out more that not only was Smith's diagnosis different, but Dr. Coons, when he sees all the information that Dr. Smith has and is made aware of what Dr. Smith has done, he changes his diagnosis to schizophrenia. Then you have additional experts talking about schizophrenia, and it all predates the trial and predates the crime.
So do you have anything else? I know you're running into your rebuttal time, but do you have anything else other than the handling of the experts that you're using for yourself to show why we ought to be persuaded by you that what the state courts did was unreasonable?
The evidence from the family was brief and very minimal. And
in the actual trial.
At the actual trial. The sister, for instance, the mother gets up and very briefly talks about, I married somebody, he was a drunk, and he was abusive. The daughter gets up and for six pages does not discuss any of that and just talks about one instance where she saw a drawing of the shadow that Overstreet was seeing. But when you compare that very brief assessment to what was put forward in the post-conviction, additional testimony from the mother, the sister goes on and on about what it was in the home life. You know, oppressive poverty. She was sent home from school because of malnourishment. Gets into the fabrics and the details of the abusive home life. He was a drunk. He was abusive, but they didn't give the details that could give a juror a true picture of what was going on in that home, other than a label that went on in that home. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Kim. Mr. Martin.
May it please the Court. This Court should affirm the District Court's denial of habeas relief because it correctly concluded that the Indiana Supreme Court had reasonably applied Strickland to these claims of ineffective assistance of counsel.
So I have a general question, which may or may not apply to the facts of this case. But anyway, do you think how do you think that factual errors should play a role in the assessment of whether a state court has reasonably applied a particular anything but Strickland here legal standard? So suppose the court makes a mistake in just a factual point.
Your Honor, it would have to be an unreasonable finding of fact by the state court.
Right, but suppose it's a yes or no fact. So not a question of judgment fact, but just a yes or no fact. Yes, I have the report in front of me. No, I don't have the report in front of me. Something fairly simple.
I find...
I mean, how could that... I mean, that's not subject to deference. I mean, you know, either the report's there or it's not there.
Correct. I mean, if something was found to exist and it's been found to conclusively not exist subsequently, and the state court relied on that, then that's not a fact that would support the judgment.
So we just delete that fact and see how it stands up based on everything else that's in the record?
Your Honor, might I inquire, are you alluding to the trial court's review of Dr. Smith's opinions at sentencing or perhaps the factual stipulation that's been brought at issue?
Well, I'm concerned that the trial court seems to have thought that it had Dr. Smith's full opinion before it, and it seems that it didn't until the post-conviction stage. And I'll tell you, just jumping right to the bottom line, what concerns me is to the extent the trial court wasn't given the full picture by these lawyers. It's not the court's fault, it's the lawyer's fault, but Indiana's a weighing state, and if the court is misled about the weight of various variables, it could easily weigh differently.
Your Honor, to address that, our position is that this was a reasonable trial strategy to go with Dr. Ingham and to offer this stipulation.
I can't see how that could possibly be, to tell you the truth. If, in fact, Dr. Smith, as he clearly did, has diagnosed actual schizophrenia.
And, Your Honor, to that point, I'd like to quote something from Dr. Smith's report that was before, that was given to trial counsels and that was in play at trial. There's a subsequent report that was offered for post-conviction review where he clarified the meaning of his diagnosis. But his initial report simply states its diagnostic impressions, one of which is schizoaffective disorder depressive type. The second is alcohol dependence and remission. In discussing that, he says, his, meaning Overstreet's, diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder is reflective of serious psychiatric illness. The mental disorder involves symptoms of major depression as well as schizophrenia. Nowhere in this report does he state that it is a discrete finding of paranoid schizophrenia and a finding of depression. He says that it features symptoms of both. Now,
here's this closing argument where these lawyers mysteriously, whoever was arguing actually finds it mysterious that they're resting with Ingham. Ingham says he's not insane, he's not schizophrenic, and yet here's somebody, and the state thinks this is gold dust. The state thinks, oh, what a fabulous thing we can argue on.
Well, Your Honor, any competent deputy prosecuting attorney is going to try to undercut the persuasive value of the mitigating evidence.
Of course. Any competent attorney would. But I'm saying if you are the lawyer for the defendant and you don't put the better evidence in, that's pretty troublesome.
Your Honor, I'd like to address that point, better evidence, in a moment, but an immediate response to your inquiry.
I'm not criticizing the trial judge at all. I mean, this is a case about effectiveness of counsel. The judge is dealing with what's put in front of her.
The way that I construe this argument, what's being argued here is that the prosecutor is now able to go to this jury and say, jury, listen, it's not like Mr. Overstreet suffers from schizophrenia. He has only a personality disorder. Well,
he may not even have that, says the judge. He's maybe faking, maybe just a hermit.
I think that was the prosecutor's comment. But of course,
the prosecutor attributes it to Dr. Ingham. Dr. Ingham said that could all have been faking.
Dr. Ingham only reasonably concluded that some persons that are under psychiatric examination when they're facing serious criminal charges have an incentive to be untruthful. He also stated he didn't think Mr. Overstreet was being untruthful, but that's what that alludes to.
Well.
But Your Honor, what I'm getting at is that Dr. Ingham told this jury exactly the opposite. I mean, the prosecutor gave his best arguments to try to minimize the import of it, but he told this jury precisely that this was quote, like schizophrenia. Well, I'm not quoting him. I'm just saying that's what he's telling him. He's giving him a definition of a disease and symptoms that show that Mr. Overstreet has suffered from psychotic symptoms, has a condition which makes him amenable to that. And if
but
I could...
But where did counsel actually put before the jury what it means to be schizophrenic? How a person like that moves through life, you know, what the voices are, what the hallucinations are. Does the jury know anything about that?
Dr. Ingham explained a distinction between schizotypal personality disorder and schizophrenia.
Right, and says Mr. Overstreet doesn't have the bad one.
Well, Your Honor, I'd have to offer a
only
a
from
more
a legal point of view, which the jury probably found pretty minimizing.
Dr. Ingham was distinguishing between what qualifies someone for an insanity defense and what would be mitigation. And here he's saying that what Mr. Overstreet suffers from is mitigation, but that's the reason why there was no insanity defense raised.
Why does the jury care about whether an insanity defense was raised or not?
Well, I think the jury's always looking to see things on a continuum to see what is more severe and what's less severe to determine how mitigating it is. And in this instance, the thing that needs to be made clear is that Dr. Ingham was the only expert that could testify to this jury that he personally, with his own eyes, observed acute psychotic symptoms being experienced by Mr. Overstreet. Everything else is historical from documentation.
Why is that important? And I have much the same concern about your submission as I do about Mr. Comp's. You're engaging in lawyer's talk, and you say, well, the fact that one psychiatrist saw symptoms with his own eyes is important. Is that important to the medical profession? Do we know whether it's important to juries? You tell me that in your view it's important, but what's the factual basis for that submission?
I think that the trial lawyer was required to assess whether this was going to be credible or not, Your Honor. And there were a number of previous evaluations that have been done on Mr. Overstreet.
You're not addressing my question.
I don't have empirical...
My problem with Mr. Comp's position, my problem with your position, is that you treat whatever lawyers say as the truth, and you have different views about what that is, but I don't think that lawyers know anything about medical issues or about what jurors do, and I'm looking for some real evidence rather than just lawyers' talk. Talk is cheap. I can argue anything.
You haven't got a bill from a lawyer recently.
Your Honor, I don't disagree with the point you're making, but and particularly with respect to what lawyers know about what the medical profession thinks. But that's not counsel's task here. Counsel's task here is to persuade this jury that these mental health conditions that they're trying to establish...
have the great benefit of the state court's findings and of the AEDPA. So if all we've got now is just lawyers talk pro and con about what's happened, your adversary's got an uphill position, but you're just asking us to assume that your lawyer's talk is better than their lawyer's talk.
I guess what
so
I'm asking...
we should do that.
I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that there's not been established a reasonable probability that this would have affected the jury one way or the other. This was something that trial counsel thought was the best way to proceed. It wasn't unreasonable because, and if I could get back to the historical data again, there have been five individuals who had assessed Mr. Overstreet's mental condition. Three of them, like Dr. Ingham and like Dr. Coons, until Dr. Coons came back on post-conviction review and massaged and changed his testimony, they all diagnosed schizotypal personality disorder.
But you see, that's the whole problem, because the lawyers didn't develop this kind of evidence that was presented at the post-conviction hearing. It's a day and night picture, you know, what shows up at the trial and then what shows up at the post-conviction. And yet the district court seems to think there's just an insignificant difference between the two of them. But at the post-conviction, we find out it's a very classic picture. Somebody starts developing these symptoms in the adolescent years. They get worse. They get worse. They get out of control. That's you know, that's the way schizophrenia develops. And yet the trial court, the trial jury, the trial judge, both of whom, of course, have a role at the time in Indiana about the death penalty, are given the smallest slice of the picture. You know, it's so hard to say that if the lawyers had really done their job properly and given them the kind of showing they did at post-conviction, and that's not relying on later acquired evidence, that's just doing the job right. It's not anything that happened between the trial and the post-conviction hearing that they were relying on.
I agree it wasn't anything that happened because the...
So they should have done the job right at the trial to show that jury first and that judge what kind... You know, the judge gives low weight to some of these things because the judge isn't convinced that this is anybody other than just somebody who just doesn't like being around people.
Your Honor, the facts that supported the post-conviction opinions that more confidently stated that Mr. Overstreet suffered from schizophrenia are the same facts that were discussed by Dr. Ingham and that were brought up by the family members at trial.
So. I think there's much, much more that comes in a post-conviction. You can read the record.
And while they went through Dr. Ingham's testimony when trial counsel presented it, they went through the evaluations of the previous doctors. They went through the DSM-4 and discussed what was specifically a brief psychotic episode, which is what happened at the prison on March 22nd. Dr. Ingham was there, and he said, Mr. Overstreet is in such a state that he can become psychotic. I saw it happen. He further told the jury, I don't know if it's ever happened in the past because I don't have the information, and I don't know if it will happen again in the future, but it could. So
right,
that
and then the information comes in spades at the post-conviction hearing that he has psychotic episodes all the time, that he sees angels, he sees demons, he has voices, he can't control his bodily movements. That's not what Dr. Ingham was saying to the jury.
Well, Your Honor, I would have to disagree. I think that it's just gilded. The evidence that came in the post-conviction hearing was an elaboration on the same kind of phenomenon that was discussed at trial.
Well, that's what you say. I don't see it that way at all. But and this is one of those things where filling in the blanks makes a big difference. By the time of post-conviction, with a full record, the medical professionals are all now saying, other than the state's person, they're all saying this man suffers from schizophrenia, which is a disease. It's not just some personality tick.
I agree. But what was told to the jury by Dr. Ingham, and which was supported by the past evaluations, wasn't some tick either.
No, they said he just had a personality disorder, not a disease.
Your Honor, I believe the jury was told that it was a serious mental illness, that he had difficulty with paranoia and had serious distortions of perceptions and reality. Dr. Ingham flagged a previous diagnosis by another professional that diagnosed a prodromal thought disorder.
Disorder, yeah.
Where he explained, and that is a fourth diagnosis aside from the schizotypal diagnoses that have been made previously. And
but what about Dr. Smith himself testifying that his diagnosis was not even, quote, pretty close, close quote, to that of Dr. Ingham? Dr. Smith doesn't seem to think these are just two very close by points on a continuum. He's a professional.
Well, Dr. Coons testified that one is a close cousin to the other, and that the distinction is how florid are the hallucinations of the delusional experiences.
Well, when the lawyers tell the trial court that Dr. Smith thinks the same thing as Dr. Ingham, and Dr. Smith actually says not even close, isn't that a problem? I'm not the one who thought that. But Dr. Smith seems to have said that.
I think that could be one problem, but another problem could be...
But that's this false stipulation problem that Mr. Comp talks about.
Another problem, Your Honor, would be, though, the jury hearing this defense team, hearing Overstreet's lawyers, tell them that for the first time since he's been seeking mental health evaluations in, I believe, 1983 was the first one, for the first time in a span all the way up to 1997, He's never been diagnosed as being schizophrenic, and now he is for the first time when he's charged with a capital murder.
Well, and then we go back into the record because it turns out his mother doesn't even like for him to go to doctors. She wants him to sit down with the Bible and pray, and so they're and people don't have access to medical care the way one might wish they did. So I'm not sure whether those lawyers even developed the access point. But we do know that when he was within the family, he was deliberately steered away from professional mental health care.
And that was something that was directly related to the jury at trial, Your Honor. Dr. Ingham spoke of that also. And counsel brought
out... So you can't get him coming and going. I mean, it's really not his fault that he didn't have a lengthy period of time during which everybody understood he had schizophrenia.
Well, Your Honor,
I'm
just suggesting trial counsel would have reasonably been concerned about the jury receiving that diagnosis now when there have been five previous diagnoses, none of which were schizophrenia. They have Dr. Ingham that has observed and told the jury observed overtly psychotic symptoms and then diagnosed him with something consistent with what the previous experts had diagnosed.
I just don't understand why, if it's now ripened into schizophrenia, understanding that this is not a disease you are born with. You know, people don't show it in younger ages. They show it later. Actually, about the time he committed this terrible, terrible crime.
Your Honor, I just feel that the psychotic symptoms were adequately related to the jury, and by doing this, they were able to stay consistent with what had been previously diagnosed, with the addition of telling the jury that Mr. Overstreet has been seen by one of their experts to become overtly psychotic. They were told also that he could become psychotic at any time if he's subjected to the right amount of stress and the right kind of conditions. They suggested that this may have happened on the night of the crimes. No other expert, and this is clear in the testimony as well, could say that they knew that Mr. Overstreet was suffering from delusions or hallucinations on the night of these crimes. At least Dr. Ingham had the ability to tell them that he, with his own clinical judgment, did observe that when he was at the prison on March 22nd. This was strategy, and I think that the Indiana Supreme Court was reasonable in finding that trial counsel selected a strategy and that it did not prejudice Mr. Overstreet. As Your Honor pointed out, these are pretty fine points, because he's been shown to be delusional. He was shown to have severe thought problems.
I said the Indiana Supreme Court said that they were fine points. I'm not sure how fine they are myself, but that's what the Indiana Supreme Court said for sure.
Your Honors, if there are no further questions regarding the presentation of mitigation, I would just briefly like to address the claim regarding the plea offer. As the Court's well aware, when you assess a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, counsel is presumed to have rendered effective assistance. Not only is there no evidence in this record that counsel failed Mr. Overstreet in any particular respect, but there is ample evidence in the record that they were careful and thorough in trying to get him to accept any kind of plea that was available. And as Your Honor has pointed out, the record doesn't have clear facts and direction on exactly what happened with respect to plea negotiations. To the extent that we're arguing about the firmness of the plea, I take no exception with Mr. Comp's characterization of the facts and that it was sent on March 22nd. It was taken to the prison to present to Mr. Overstreet on that day, and presumably, had Mr. Overstreet been willing to accede to the terms of the agreement and sign it and go forward in that fashion, I don't know that the state was not willing to accept that.
Let's take it in two steps. Step number one, which as I understand is your position, is that Mr. Overstreet was perfectly fine when it was presented to him, and then he had the psychotic episode at some later time. Possibility number two is the minute he sees it, he flips into a psychotic state. And then there's a serious question about whether there's been an effective presentation of the plea to begin with.
I think the record refutes the second scenario that you presented, Judge. That is because his sister's testimony at post-conviction made very clear that when Overstreet was presented with the plea offer, his response to her was, I can't remember, and I'm not going to admit to doing things that I don't have a memory of, acts that I don't remember committing. That is a rational reason for not accepting the plea offer. Whatever happened after that, that's a rational response. Regardless, the state is not required.
It's a bizarre, you may be right, it's a bizarre form of rationality, since most people actually do remember what they did. And he's saying the memory is zero from that evening.
And there are numerous references in the record to him saying he can't believe he would have done such a thing, and that he doesn't have memory of committing the acts. That's a good reason not to plead guilty. The plea, as they say, would have been in his best interest.
I take it Indiana has some way where you can say, well, I've seen what the prosecutor has, so I am going to plead guilty because I believe, you know, from the prosecutor's evidence that I did it, even though I don't remember. That's not quite a best interest plea. That's a confession plea.
The petitioner found a couple of older Indiana cases where that kind of thing was discussed, Your Honor. And I would submit that not only has Indiana case law become increasingly rejecting of that kind of a scenario in a plea negotiation sense, but in a capital case where you have to have, where you're requiring, and Petitioner's Exhibit 14, the facts plea agreement, requires petitioner to admit that he intentionally murdered Kelly Eckert while committing or attempting to commit rape. If he's going to say he has a foggy memory on that, that certainly is a good reason why the state wouldn't, and that's what I want to say about the firmness. If that was his response, then it's quite reasonable and predictable that the state would say that's not going to be an adequate admission of guilt for us to enter into this agreement. And then there's the additional concern of whether the trial court's going to accept the agreement, because that's required by law as well. It's interesting because when Mr. Overstreet, according to his counsel...
So people who suffer from amnesia will always get the death penalty, right? They don't have a chance to plead to a charge that would be life in prison without parole. Because under Indiana law, there's no way they can accept the truth of the state's case and admit guilt.
Your Honor, I have to say, I think that whether the prosecutor is willing to agree to that factual basis and that acceptance of responsibility is the threshold question. Now,
right. It just strikes me as so odd that the really hardened criminal, you know, gang leader who goes out and ruthlessly murders people can enter into a plea, but the amnesiac can't.
It is an odd situation, Your Honor. But my point is simply that there's no evidence here that counsel wasn't effective.
In the original Alfred case, if you remember, the government put on a case, even after the court conditionally accepted the plea. And after 4 days of hearing, His Honor said that they had proved their point. There's nothing that stops an amnesiac from saying, put on your case. And unless I have a rebuttal to present or some cross-examination, you've got to accept it. And they could accept that. So you don't have to pry because you can't remember.
I had not considered that, Your Honor, but that's logical and makes sense. In this instance, I think it's interesting when Mr. Overstreet finally says that he's willing to take the plea, we have no information about what the character of the plea offer is at that point. Is it the same one that was taken up on March 22nd? We don't know. We do know that at that point, Mr. Overstreet is aware of the possibility of pleading. One would presume from that, when you presume counsel effective, that counsel kept him abreast of whatever the character was of the plea offer, if there was, in fact, one. If the court has no further questions...
I've got at least one. My colleague asked Mr. Comp about Lafler. I have the same question for you. I was puzzled in light of the grant of certiorari in Lafler that your brief seems to concede that bad advice or bad work by a lawyer during the plea negotiation stage permits collateral relief, even if the defendant had a full and fair trial. Is that still your position?
It is not still my position, Your Honor. I was unaware of Lafler until I was made aware of it by petitioner's reply brief. I've since listened to the oral arguments, and I'm aware of what's at issue.
I think it's still your position. We'll go with the position in your brief. You certainly did not make the argument that the state is making in Lafler.
Which, Your Honor, is that a fair trial negates any
that
deficiencies
is the argument
by counsel.
The state is making in Lafler. But it was not an argument that the state of Indiana has made at any time in this case until 30 seconds ago.
And, Your Honor, I concede I was unaware of the holding when
you didn't have to know about Lafler to make the argument.
That's true, Your Honor. The state would ask this court to affirm the denial of habeas relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Anything further, Mr. Kopp?
May it please the court. Going back to the distinction, Judge Woods brought up the DSM. I don't think it's attorney speak or lawyer speak. You know, the DSM are psychiatric and psychologists and doctors, and they've delineated a substantial difference between personality disorders and schizophrenia.
You know, you may still be misunderstanding my question. It didn't have anything to do with whether there is a difference between these medical conditions that the medical profession recognizes. The question I asked was whether there's any reason to believe that jurors would be more lenient with people who are diagnosed in one way than who are diagnosed in the other way. You express confidence that the answer is yes. The Indiana judiciary found that the answer is no. Right? What you want us to do is prefer your lawyer speak over their finding. Now, if you've got some medical, psychological, some other reason to believe that your view is a sounder view than the state court's view, we really need to know it.
Okay. I would...
And it should be in the record.
That too.
There is a study by Marley Sandys, and it discusses it's sort of pulls together all the different empirical studies and discusses how jurors and all the...
Did you cite that in your brief?
No, we did not.
Why?
Because we felt on the face of the record, the arguments made by the trial prosecutor, how the trial court, when it discounted the mitigation simply because he didn't go get help, we felt that how the state courts treated this evidence when it was in front of the jury and when it was being weighed were sufficient to demonstrate the unreasonableness of the state court determination under Strickland.
So you omitted it because you're confident that as a matter of law, lawyers' talk is better than social science.
No, absolutely not.
You can't be right.
No.
Give me the full citation to this article.
I don't know the name of I don't have the full. It's a survey of capital juror studies. It's done by Marla Sandys, Sandys is her last name.
Survey of what?
It's a survey of capital jury studies. What she did is she reviewed all the different jury studies and refined what the conclusions were.
Enlighten me. What constitutes a jury study?
What they do is they give
what the charge was and what the jury did, or
they give in front of these they give questions I believe it's like either people that were capital jurors or who would be your typical capital juror and get responses on what is more mitigating versus what is less mitigating. And in that
you mean they selected former capital jurors?
I think Sandy's study is pulling together all the different jury studies. Some of them were done with, I believe, capital jurors and some were not. And what she did is she then sort of went through all the data
And came to a legal conclusion.
Came to a conclusion, whether it's legal or
well, I assume it wasn't medical.
Correct.
An empirical conclusion, it sounds like. What did juries find persuasive?
Correct, and that's what it was. And the schizophrenia was up there. It was found one of the most persuasive mitigators after residual doubt, mental retardation, and then being a juvenile. So it's and obviously after Atkins, the mental retardation mitigators are relevant, and I believe after Cooper, the juvenile.
These were all capital offense cases?
It's a study of capital juries and what they found mitigated.
Only capital juries. Not.
I believe so. I don't want to misspeak because it's what another component of Sandy's study is that it sort of hinges upon how jurors assess mitigation is whether or not it's the defendant's fault. For instance, if I was here standing arguing today, well, look, my client was voluntarily got intoxicated.
That's part of your problem. As I understand what the Indiana judiciary is saying about this, it says that both schizophrenia and schizoaffective personality disorder, or any of the other ways of putting this, are ways of telling the jurors that Overstreet was not morally blameworthy. Right? So you've got two or perhaps three different ways of trying to tell the jury that Overstreet's not morally blameworthy. Your submission seems to rest on a belief that one of these words has much more punch than the other. That's what really, you know, seems to me an empirical question, whether it does have more punch when you've got multiple ways of saying not morally blameworthy. I know there are studies out there that say that jurors are less likely to vote for capital punishment when there's mitigation evidence addressing the question of blameworthiness than when there isn't.
Correct.
That's easy to believe. What's more difficult, and what seems to me important to know the empirical answer on, are there important differences among the ways of arguing for lack of moral blameworthiness?
And I believe Sandy's materials address that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Mr. Comp, we appreciate your willingness and that of your co-counsel to accept the appointment in this case. These capital cases are very difficult, and they obviously call for a very large commitment of time, and so the judiciary as well as your client very much appreciates your assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.